that car's slowing up, looking out to see if they can drop the boat in.
Well, how you doing?
This is Tommy.
Mr. Tommy, that's Marvin.
Well, he knows. He wants to make you feel good.
Well, I'm Mr. Miles. And she got so sick, she went to the doctor, and he put her in the hospital just from worrying.
Well, I worry about everything that comes along.
Yeah.
I can't help it. If you in trouble, it worries me.
Yeah.
Anybody.
It worries if you're not in trouble. She just worries anyway.
How about that?
Cindy.
Well, I pass by here every now and then. Every time I do, I just wonder what in the world you're all up to. And I never see anybody. I come along here a while ago and I saw you back then. I thought, well, sir, I'll just go.
Oh,
well, we passed
we just got
six,
in.
And I said,
we just got in.
Who is that, Mr. Bowen? And he said, no, that's Miles, look like. I said, no, that ain't.
Oh, was that your truck?
Yeah.
I didn't look up. I was looking out there at that
yeah,
alligator.
You're standing. Was it alligator?
I thought it was alligator.
It probably was.
Yeah. Not bad, right?
No, we gone half of the time. The biggest half.
What are you doing? Playing with the tape recorder? Well, how do you have it hooked up?
Huh?
How do you have it hooked up?
Yes,
well, I
thought it's right there. I got another one here, you see. And it's all out in the open.
He would never notice anything like that, would he?
Well, the thing of it is, as long as it's not conspicuous, if you just got everything.
It's conspicuous to me.
It is.
No, I mean it's not real conspicuous, you know. But do you ever have people that you know are real funny about it?
Well, I don't take this to anyone.
True.
As is anybody who's funny about it, see, I wouldn't. It wouldn't be in the first place. Of course, that's about all I'm interested in is people who are interested
right.
in such things. Or who are, you know.
Well, real natural.
Talk about. I don't have any, I've got to the point where I just pare away the others. I just don't put my time in on them.
The ones that are institutionalized.
That's right. Well, you can't do that altogether, but I mean, by and large, the people that hang around out here, you know, all about it is the same thing. You remember Nick?
Sure.
Now, you haven't heard Nick's report. Let me tell you what he did. He took little pieces. Nick is not a scholar, but he's perceptive. He's one of the few who come out here who ever do anything. He made most of that.
He made that too, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, let me tell you. On his, he came back Thanksgiving. He came up here on purpose to report. You know how I use the word report.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what he came to do. And he had a thesis.
Yeah.
He had his, you know, his inquiry.
Yeah.
His inquiry. And, horses ought to open the countryside for you. Did we talk about that?
Mm-mm.
Well, that was it. Now, the reverse of that is that people who like English horses out here, that would cut them off from the countryside.
Mm-hmm. One of those institutions.
Yeah.
You have to know exactly how to do it and just what to do.
Yeah, the Western manner, you see, is a little bit more open.
Natural.
Yes. Well, Nick pursued that all fall at Swanee. And he ran into a fellow there that had a horse and he couldn't ride him, and Nick rode for him, took out the horse. And the first little, you know, they have those shows, it's not shows, whatever it's called, games, they all get together. he Nick wrote one, and he just took Nick around and introduced him to everybody. Well, you don't didn't introduce him, but he go around with him and get acquainted with everybody. And that way he knows. You see, that little thesis took him into the countryside, and he reported on it. And he reported on the people he saw and their attitude towards things. And why it is that Alvin put these cows out here and starve them. And he sees those things. And he worked with Cookie, you see, all summer. And he had that to go on. One thing, they'll work, swap, and do everything, but they try not to put out any money. Fertilizer seems to be the rock that on which they sit. Now you see, $100 worth of fertilizer.
It's worth all kinds of stuff.
You split it, $50 a piece. And but they can find money for everything with fertilizer. Well, he was Nick had noticed that. And he kept that in his mind, and he found out a lot more about him than I ever knew. And that's what he did. He came home, came down here Thanksgiving to report. And that's what I'd like to, you see, I don't teach, I try not to be academic in my teaching. You know, up there, I try to bring it to some point.
No, it's real enjoyable, and I don't think anyone that, you know, I don't think anyone that takes the other course that I took should take that without the other one first.
That's right.
Because you get it, you know, I got it to a certain extent, but you don't really get it unless you learn from the other way.
You don't know what you get.
So it's kind of not worth it. Because you only get half of it, and you just don't get the whole point.
You don't really get enough to hold on to.
But you know, your class, I enjoy sitting in the back of your class watching the kids. Because some of them are never going to get it.
No.
And they're turned off right from the very beginning, and they're not willing to put anything out. And they sit and they grumble, you know, and mutter under their breath. And some of them are, you know, willing, more willing. But it seems to me that you'd have a lot of trouble getting, how many do you ever get to?
Susan, you've got that in every class.
Well, I know. I teach. I know that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
And it's worth it for the two or three.
But, no, it's more than that.
But see,
okay.
Well, in freshman class.
No, you've lost the battle already.
No, it's worth it, too. Yeah. To me, it is. I enjoy it because there are a few that are interested. Not maybe they're not interested in English, but they're just interested in just looking around, learning a few things.
Yes, that's right.
Which most people aren't, especially freshmen. But see, the thing is, you get them when it's almost too late, because they're already used to all this other stuff, and they come in your class, and it's a big shock, you know.
Yeah.
And some of them never adjust to it, some of them do.
Yeah. I don't find it any different. I find I can get hold of more in this group than I can in the other group.
You mean in an older group or a freshman?
Any group. I mean,
that's because they're just starting to get into English courses and they haven't been completely.
I can do better with beginners than I can with the old ones. At least I always have. But things change. No, what I meant was with this subject and this approach, I get farther than I do on some other subject.
Yeah. You get farther with fewer, you mean?
No.
You get more of them.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
My freshmen are interesting in some ways. They're so afraid, and so they've been so clamp down on it, they're not willing to let loose with anything. And it's real hard to get them to, I enjoy it, but it's real hard to get them to think about anything.
Yeah.
In any other way than that which they've been taught.
Yeah.
And you have to see, what you don't do is you don't try and goad them into it. Like, see, when I teach, I try and, you know, I'll do anything to stand on my head in the corner to get them to get a few of them to see. Not in the same way, though. Like that kid the other day that was saying something, you know, and you clamped down on him, and he got all hot under the collar, you know, and he was sitting there. But then it was over by the end of class, you know, and he's... But some of them would never get over something like that, though, would they? They just go through the whole course and just...
Yeah, that's right. That's very easy to
because
create hostility.
They're not used to the approach.
This is... The approach you see now is mild. It's cut down to a voltage about a flashlight caliber compared to what I used to do.
Well, how did you used to do it?
Oh, I'd be armed. Yes, but you see.
Well, you do now.
Oh, it was such a low voltage.
Well, you try and sneak it up on them now. It's the whole.
No, I just don't let them feel the full effect of it.
That's true, because when you were handling Thoreau, see, I know exactly, you know, I can see it now, what I couldn't see before, the way with Twain and Thoreau, you let him wander around a little bit and make a few stabs at it, and then when you get to Emerson, you just sort of unload the whole thing, and then they can look back.
Mm-hmm.
You don't let them get off, though, on their own. You know, they want to take it in some other direction.
Yes.
And they keep bugging you to let them, you to let them go.
I let them go in any direction, won't you? Except
the only one they know how to do. Really, I mean, really.
Yeah,
it's the only thing they know.
They actually can't take it, you know. You stay with it a little while, and this will open up more of the hazards in reading that everybody has, everybody. Than any little reading material I see. Susan, you see, it came to a head in that little part of Emerson's on what he called action. The course came to a head. Well, now you see it, but. I'll go over that a dozen.
Well, only because I've been through all the other before, and I was already on the verge of knowing that from before.
Yeah.
I just didn't have the words, you know. I hadn't read the stuff before in that way.
Yeah. You didn't have control of it. That's what worried me. You see.
Well, I see it now.
Yeah. Well,
so
you see the beginning of it.
Well, see, the thing that my immediate reaction to what we were doing in class the other day is to try and apply it to something I know about.
Sure.
And to see if it works out.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure. I think I know it, and then I try to do it, you know, and it's still a little bit shady,
yes.
You know.
Well,
but
you
I think
see,
I have it.
The rest of the course, we'll be using
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's
and that's the way I like to handle material, bring it to bear. And you'll never get to the end of it. Every day there's something else will open up, and at the last day, still, you know. Now, you stated the point that Emerson makes that we use, and the point that he calls action.
Well,
I don't mean stated. I mean just talking about.
There are a number of things that brought it home. The way you started into it without getting to the action and thought dichotomy, or the way action issues into thought. First, the idea that you have to be guided by your first thought. I like that. I like to think about that. And it really brought it home to me when you were talking about the institutionalization that most people are subjected to, and how it ruins everything that you want to bring out, because it's it classifies it, just what you were talking about. You know, I wish today I was going to bring this poem, and I forgot to bring it. There's a poem by Robert Graves. Have you ever heard of it, called A Cool Web?
No.
Just what you were talking about. It's the idea that children, before they've been institutionalized, can see things in a certain way. before they have language. But later, when you get language, it's this whole idea of classification that it dulls the first thought or dulls the experience. And you can never really come in contact with experience again. Once you've had this system, this institutionalization, and it's exactly what you were saying.
Oh, sure, tell me.
I will. I was just teaching it the other day in class, and my kids were talking about it. Mm-hmm. And they saw it, you know, and they picked that up, just what you were talking about, the classification.
But they couldn't appreciate it.
They didn't see it in the whole.
Yeah. Huh?
They didn't see it in the whole perspective. Yeah. But they did get an inkling, though, of the idea.
Inklings don't help.
Well, yeah, but I couldn't really pick it up in my class.
I'm just talking with you.
No, I know. But, I mean, that would have been a good thing to do, I think.
Those inklings are what I call, when I jumped you the other day, the tag-ins of thought.
Yeah.
They're not systematic. They're not orderly. They're not really vehicles of thought. They're not something that you can use.
Well, the whole idea of direction that you're talking about is what it is. That's what you can use. You start off with the little way to get into it, which is what you write on the other course, which I didn't really understand because I didn't see it in this way. That you have to have just one little thing that opens the whole thing up, that throws a light on it as you go through the subject.
But the way it was, that point that's so revealing from Eric Fromm doesn't open it up for them. They don't have enough background. That education consists of the concepts that students can translate into the experience. They can't handle it. It's sad.
That's the whole idea that you said, that bright students like classification. They get all these lists and things that they can hold in their mind, but they can't, that's the thought, and they can't relate that to the action because it just, it's completely separate. It doesn't grow out of the experiences they've had. If they did like Emerson, like you say, it's a thought without the action. If they did that, had the action, then drew it from that, then it would mean something. But education isn't that way.
Well, I was put out with you that time out here, and I talked to you right sharp. You remember that?
Yeah.
I told you it was tagging the stuff. Now, tell me what I said to you.
You mean that I was telling you, I was trying to justify some of the things I learned in graduate school?
Mm-hmm.
That you said it doesn't do any good because it just, it doesn't fit into any system, is what you were saying.
Well, give it, don't,
which
don't,
is
don't,
true.
Don't give me the substance of it, give me the experience, the detail.
Well, you know, this is what it made me think about was the whole idea of graduate school, you know, and what I'm doing right now has, since quite a while, in fact, since I took your course, it's not any fun anymore. You know, I don't have any, well, let's put it this way, before the course, before I had your course, school was everything to me. That was what I did. And I did it well, and that was what I was going to keep on doing. But after that, as you say, you thought I didn't get the idea that you have to approach it with a position of doubt. But I did. You know, I've had a long time, and that's why graduate school, it's not anything to me anymore. Because it's not what I want to do now. You know, I'd rather just quit and just go on, look at experience like what you've been talking about.
Wouldn't that be marvelous?
Yeah, but see, I can't do it because the only alternative is to quit and get a job from 8 to 5 every day. That is worse on me than school is.
You see, that's what's her old face.
Sure, I know. So when I was reading through, I said, exactly, exactly. You have to get away from the convention so that you can do what you want to look at the real part of life.
Yeah.
But see, now I'm prevented either way from doing that.
Give me some of your tag-ins, like you said, you could see examples of all around. Don't you know, one had to do with philology or something.
You mean linguistics?
Linguistics.
The idea of studying different dialects.
Yes.
Well, now, you may not think that you...
Be leisurely about it and let me enjoy it.
Well, what I was trying to tell you, and I'm not sure that I don't still feel this way, is that when I've had several linguistics courses, right? Especially from the anthropological point of view, that approach it as manifestations of different cultures. Okay, well, they talk about it as controlling the thought of different cultures.
Open the door.
It doesn't matter.
Are you stuffy?
No, I'm not too.
If you are, just open it. I'm not stuffy.
I don't care.
They
talk about it as controlling the thought of different people. Well, learning about that, thinking about these other cultures, and then going out to Hawthorne and looking at the way they speak, their whole dialect, I think it helped. You know, it gave me an insight into the way that people think and how different it is from the way I think and the way a lot of other people think.
Yeah, you're just dwelling on abstractions.
Well, I told you about the story about...
that's what I want to hear.
I told you the story about being in the classroom and the things that the kids would come up with, which, if I hadn't really thought about it, you know, and hadn't learned some of these things about differences in dialect and usage, you know, in different cultures, subcultures, I probably wouldn't have appreciated it as much. I'm going to tell you. You know, my little 7th grade class especially, because they never wanted to study anything. You know, they just wanted to fool around, which is what we did. Most of the time it was more fun than what I was supposed to teach them. But there were a lot of interesting little kids in there that didn't want to do anything but just talk all the time themselves. We were talking about thunder one day and what causes thunder. And I asked the class, what makes thunder? And this little kid in the back of the class, named Napoleon, raised his hand, Napoleon. He raised, except he didn't answer to Napoleon. You see, his family pronounced it Napoleon.
Oh.
And so if you said Napoleon, he didn't click. You know, he had to say Napoleon. And he raised his hand. He never raised his hand. He raised his hand, so I called on him, and I said, what makes thunder? And he said, God do. So you see, he had an answer. And it was part of that whole subculture that just has a lot of different answers for things than we do. Now, I don't know. They all had little stories like that, little, like the guy that also thought that thunder was caused by the devil beating his wife.
Mm-hmm.
That was his theory. They all had a little theory, you know, it wasn't related to anything that I wanted to hear, but see, I enjoy hearing that a lot more than I did if they told me the right answer.
Yeah.
They had a lot of good stories.
Yeah.
I enjoy hearing them
tell stories. I tell you, Susan, you're one of the few people who can actually use the material that they read. Most that I see, I never get any contact, actually. No, whatsoever with them.
Well.
So let me tell you what I was going to tell you. You see, we can bat this back and forth, and it'll help me see kind of some of these things, and if you talk to me, you can tell when you're on the deep end, where you got to hold something that's not possible.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be interesting, just back and forth. Now, what was the...
Nothing.
What was the little settlement out there, the shantytown or something that you were telling me about?
Oh, the Mullinses.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to write about that sometime.
What were you saying about them?
They live outside of Hawthorne.
Yeah.
Right on the outskirts. And it, before I ever started to teach there, you know, I came to the school before I had to actually start teaching, and all the teachers said, watch out for the Mullins kids. You know, they are white trash, and they're no good. You know, none of the kids are any good. They have 4 or 5 kids. I'm not really sure. I think they have 1 girl and 4 boys. But they have this little house on the outside of Hawthorne, and every day on the way to school, I drive by there, and I look in, and I try to see inside the door. Have you ever done that? You know, drive by someone's house you're really curious about, and every time you go by, you take a closer look to try and pick up all the little bits and pieces of information that you can get about their lives. I always try and look inside their house, because they're just these two wooden shacks, sort of lean together. And the whole outside of the house is just covered with junk. You know what I mean? It's like a flea market. It's like the Hanging Gardens. It's incredible. Every time I go by there, I notice something else about this house. They have a mattress. They have an old wringer washer. They have food sitting outside there. They have hanging flowers. They have detergent. They have a little pump. I don't know if they have plumbing, but every once in a while I go by there, I see one of them out there pumping water. It's right on the edge of their porch. It's just covered, the whole outside of the house. And so I was real curious about, you know, this house. So I went to Hawthorne to teach, and I met two of the kids, Larry, who was in the eighth grade, and Bruce, who was a senior in high school. And I was teaching both of them. Didn't teach Bruce too much, though, because he was going to vocational school, and he used to leave right in the middle of class. But Larry was the one that was really interesting. Because here I'd heard that there were, you know, white trash. Don't mess around with these kids. You know, they're not any good. This was the teacher's viewpoint of these kids. So I went to the classroom, and I met Larry. And he was a character, you know. He sort of led the class. And they looked to him, you know, for... Not in any scholarly endeavors, you understand. Just, you know... in foolishness. That's all most of them are interested in anyway. But he was a character. But he was a real likable little guy. I was in there more than about 2 weeks, and I just loved him. He was just a great kid. He would, he never did anything in class except draw racing cars or talk about hunting with his friends, you know, and he didn't care beans about English. I didn't really care about him learning English either. But I was interested in getting him to talk about his family, because I heard about him, and I saw this house that they lived in. So I used to have him do little speeches, more for my own benefit than for theirs. I'd get him to get up in front of the class, talk about hunting, you know, and the things that they were interested in, and they could really talk about those things. Well, Larry was a real troublemaker, though, besides just talking about his hunting. And there's one thing about him that really got to me. It was his dislike of the little colored kids. And he would try to pick fights, and he'd get furious. He just had a temper. It was unbelievable. There was one kid in the back of the class named Oscar, a little colored boy. It had, obviously, when he was young, it had his face burned or something. There was some disfiguration of his face, and he had a real problem. He always carried this little blanket around with him. And he'd sit in the back of the class, and during the middle of class, constantly he'd be saying, "Ah ha." You know, trying to disturb the class. And Larry would get furious, not so much because he was disturbing the class, as because it was a colored kid that was doing it. One day he went back there, and he just punched the guy right in the face and walked out, and he knew that I would be mad at him, so when he went out, he also put his hand right through the door. He just smashed his fist right through the door. And I was mad. I went outside and I saw him, and he was crying. He was really upset that he'd all these conflicting feelings, you know. He knew that he'd done something that I didn't like, and he knew he'd done something that was going to get him in trouble, and he was just a mess. But a couple days later, he came up after class, and he said, "Can I do a book report on a book about the Ku Klux Klan?" And I said, "No." The class was half or three-quarters colored, and I said, "No. Can't do a book report on the Ku Klux Klan." He said, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, I don't think it'd be right." And he said, "You mean to tell me that you like niggers?" And he was serious. He wasn't being funny. He just was really curious that I could really like these colored kids in my class. But he was a funny kid, you know, as much as you'd think that at home he would pick up all kinds of terrible language, but he didn't. He'd sit there in class, and you'd say something to him. You'd call him down for something, or you'd call on him in class, and he wouldn't come out with anything. But his favorite word was mercy. Everything he did, it was mercy, mercy. You'd call on him in class, and he'd say, he'd start stuttering, you know, he couldn't say anything. And he'd say, "What is it, Larry?" And he'd say, "Mercy, mercy, you make me so nervous." And I just had a bad effect on him. You know, we could never really communicate. I don't know. His brother, though, his older brother, was already, he was already what I called ruined. You know, he'd already been, by this whole attitude of the school, that his family was white trash. He'd already been clamped down on. He'd been in trouble with the police. He was a completely different personality. He'd been just a... He wasn't any good for anything anymore. He was sullen. He was bitter. You couldn't get close to him. I tried to talk to him, you know, but you couldn't at all. And it's funny to me how different, because Larry was still within his family. He was still involved in his family and not so much at school. But Bruce had come out of his family and had been put down and was completely different from Larry. And it's funny, you know, you try to get to know a family like that. I tried to, because I was really curious about their whole, the way they live, their whole setup. But it's every day I drive by there and look in that door, and that's about as close as I've ever gotten.
You never stop to see him.
No, I tried that before, but he's real shy of me. You know, Larry, even the little one, is real shy because he knows that I know what the other people think about him.
Well, his mama.
Pardon?
His mama.
Well, yeah, the laundromat where I do my wash in Hawthorne is right across, almost across the street. And every once in a while I walk down by there while I'm doing my laundry. But I never see anybody except Larry outside. Usually he's toting a gun around just coming back from hunting.
Mom and Papa not there?
His father's real sullen. I've waved to him and said hi to him before, but he just looks at the ground, doesn't say anything. They're not, you know, they've been isolated by the community. And I'm part of the group that has done that to them. And I can't, you know, I can't get close to them at all. The only access I had was while I was teaching there in school.
Larry,
right. Because Larry was the only one that hadn't been... It was beginning, you could see it, you know, with the color business, you know, in the classroom. And he was starting to build up that same thing that Bruce had had. But,
Well, now, what are you driving at? What's your direction?
Well... The thing that's always bothered me about the whole thing is the fact that I couldn't, no matter what I did, I couldn't really get into the family situation.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it's just like driving by the house every day.
Yeah.
Every day we drive in, drive out, and I look at that house and I'm really curious.
But you didn't have to go to school there, so then.
No, it's true.
You have to have a pretty complicated brain.
What the whole thing, you know what I was telling you before about the anthropological approach, you know, and this linguistic thing, is something that really made me conscious of this sort of, these different divisions. The way Larry's family's cut off and how it's a completely different setup. And I would have known that before, right? But now I'm even more conscious of it.
You mean the anthropological approach in your linguistics courses?
Yeah.
But you're not using linguistics.
No, but it's part of it, though, because when you go out to Hawthorne, you listen to the way they talk. That's part of the whole subculture. It's part of the whole way they look at things.
Well, nice. Now, tell me, what's Emerson trying to do in that little section, action?
You mean action issues into thought?
Yes.
Well, I think he's saying that you have your experience.
Yeah.
And that
you have to live.
You have to live, right? And one thing too that I think is interesting, I just realized that you have to live, but it doesn't have to be exotic. You know, I used to always think that to live, to be able to examine your experience, you had to have exotic experiences.
Yeah.
So I would try to do all these things that were completely off the wall, you know, to get these different experiences.
Yeah.
And like I went into caving, you know, I learned all that caving. I used to hitchhike all around with different people. Now this was in my, this was a pretty long time ago. But, you know, I can see it now. It's like Thoreau. It doesn't have to be exotic because that's not where the heart of it is. That when you have the experience, like Thoreau did, like Emerson is saying, then that you don't move away from it, but the thought grows out of it. And you have to trust your own insight into that experience.
But now, he doesn't tell you there the method by which thought goes out of experience. I told you that. I'm not sure that he can tell you that.
No. What does he have to say about direction, too?
The inquiry. Of course, that's...
He doesn't say that.
That's at the heart of it. And it's also the heart of the others. They may not say it, but that's the heart of it.
Well, that's the whole Thoreau method. It's, he keeps exploring these different... He carries them out.
Yeah.
From the experience, he draws his thought.
Yeah, he tests.
Now, Mark Twain has got the action, but not the thought. Thoreau's got both, and Emerson's got the thought.
Mark Twain's got thought, too.
Well, but it's not in the same manner as Thoreau. He doesn't contemplate.
Yeah, it's more skillful than Thoreau.
Yeah. it's within the action. You have to
yes.
You have to watch his direction from just the action that he relays.
That's better that way. You see, you all your talk now, you've just been laboring your points.
That's why I always do it.
Yeah. And it's right painful to listen to.
That's what he always says.
No.
Just the way my mind works.
But you know,
I'm a brooder.
No,
I'm not one of the people that just...
No, but you can learn from rushing it. And,
I can.
Yes, you can. You sure can. You can have a very light inquiry, and very light.
Well, see, the thing for me is an effort to make it light. That doesn't seem right. Why should it be an effort? You have to, you know, you move to the way you are, which is, you know, laboring the points, and then you have to move away from that.
Why not?
Why not be what it is?
Yeah. I, of course, that's the question I faced in that little study I made called Three Studies. It's a tape. It's filled up with one of these reels.
Mm-hmm.
I don't fill it, but it's three studies, Mr. Patterson, Mr. Morrison, and Mr. Gilbert. All different. All my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. They all have a thesis in their natural talk. There's a direction to it, you see, that I wasn't aware of until I got into it. You'd think what it is, you'd think it's nothing. But then Mr. Morganson I caught him last year when he was interested in Governor. Alabama, you know.
Wallace.
Governor Wallace. And he was argumentative. He was, I've worked on that. And what I found was that he was making very simple statements. He was just laboring them. And he gave the attitude of hostility. And he wasn't actually hostile.
Mm-hmm.
It was his approach.
Mm-hmm.
And Ms. Herbert, Jean Herbert, was out here, and that's the only thing she ever heard that I did on tape. And I told her about that, and she mixes, she knows people. You know, she's in contact with affairs, public affairs. And Faye said, that she told her, that was an insight into the Wallace movement. That their positions weren't nearly as disturbing as they seemed to be, for the simple reason they had they hit the thesis so hard it distorted the information, the experience.
Right. Well, yeah, you've been saying that for a while, but it's hard for me not to do that.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is. You haven't tried it from the inside.
No. Yes, I remember your paper. But you
because see the thing is you want to explore it from all directions. This is always my problem.
Yeah.
And then it comes down too hard. You can't just pick one thing and let it go.
Yeah. No, you've got constantly refining on your season.
Right. See, so that it's a habit, you know, for one thing.
Yes.
It's just a.
No, you get over that, and it'll be such a relief, just like quit smoking.
When do I get over that?
It won't take you long.
See,
you haven't been out here and talked, except all you do is come out here and, what's the word? Quip.
Not me, I just listen.
Just come out here and quip. Say bright and light. No.
I never say bright be Mari. That's John's job. I listen.
It won't take any time at all. You get so put out of that the distortion of your material that you can't stand to labor your point.
I will, huh?
I'm still working on it, but I can see. Makes me intolerant of other people doing it.
Oh, well, I'm like that now. It's like the people that dropped in on me last weekend. You know, I was irritated to death. I could have just thrown them out after they were there an hour, you know, because they sat and talked about nothing for hours. And I was sitting there, you know, come on. But now, see, I've known that for a long time. I don't hang around with people that I don't care to talk with. Yeah, don't have anything to say. Don't want to talk about anything except make social remarks. That's what happens when you go to parties. You know, you go to some party that some friend of some friend asked you to, and you go there and you waste 3 or 4 hours doing nothing. Isn't that true?
I think that's a remarkable little section called Visitors in Walden. He had more visitors at Walden than he had had before, and he also met them on more favorable terms.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't know what'd be favorable for you, but in my way of thinking, no, it's a back fence.
Yeah, okay.
A fence, so to speak.
Yeah, that's not with my next door neighbor on Hawthorne.
Sure.
That's, there are about 3 people I like to talk to, and he's low. But, you know, I have these people dropping in on me that, you know, you don't want to. It's just a big waste of time.
Mr. Eastman spent a good deal of time up here. We've taped him and talked to him. Had a very fine time. One of the high moments out here was his talk about his Morgan Hutchins. He came up that Sunday afternoon in his Sunday clothes and with Liz Eastman and in their tan station wagon and brought their album. And we sat in the parlor in there and looked at those photographs. And see all the magic went out of the Morgan horses. They were just old, plain draft horses. And you just didn't want to see another score there.
Yeah.
And he was making conversation in the front room.
Making conversation.
Yeah, well, see, there aren't very many people around that are different from that, really. I mean, really. Not that I know. Now, see, that's the thing.
Oh, you know, Sir Ossesis. Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
A man, he says, will never let you down.
Mm.
It's one of the light-heartedest things you ever saw, and it's in that same paragraph.
Yeah, I remember.
A man will never let you down.
Mm.
But you got to have that.
You got to have the right place and the right approach. Yeah, no, I must not have it because all my friends.
Seems to me the thing is to within yourself, you know. You got to do some social things. I mean, this, but you still can keep this island, and you still. In my case, I'm constantly working on this business of not being heavy. Even though I get to where it's pretty awful. Even with my music friends. You know, I've got some music friends that have
you know, they're from Yale and they're from Juilliard and they're from Sorbonne.
Yeah,
and,
I know the type.
You know, they're French, there's one French, one from Tokyo. But I just almost have to get up and walk out. They can't say anything about their own profession.
No.
But still I've got to sit there, you know, I can't just mark them off my list.
Well, most students are especially bad about that because they're in this thing, you know. They... Just like English graduate students, what is your main, you know, your main function is to turn out papers, you know, on points that you can, anybody can do it, anyone with half a mind can do it. Just take a point, develop it, turn in the paper. You know, it's useless. The only thing that's good about it is your contact with your reading. To me, that's the only thing that's worth it. You go and sit in the class, and that's not worth it. You write the papers, and that's the biggest waste of time I've ever seen. Because they're nothing, you know, anyone could do it. It's the same thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You have these friends, you know, that you sit around and talk to, but not say anything.
Well, you just sitting there, are you? We're just talking about one pretty chat. But I don't think I'll get too hot.
That little section of the action, now you see, I interpret that in the life of a radio study and working with people like you. Well, not like you, because they're not many like you.
Lucky.
But with Mr. Patterson and people like that,
mm-hmm.
See? So I've changed it. I've shifted it. I'm not interested in converting thought into action. Experience and the thought. It's examining. See, I use his own term, inquiry, and examine. Look at the experience. And so it'll be mental.
Mm-hmm.
It can be used.
Mm-hmm.
And see what an easy touch it is. But it comes after such great labor.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
I
can't see the end of that labor. To me, it just seems.
Just labor. Let me tell you what Suzanne, I tried to tell you that before, what Suzanne said. She'd been taking courses, and of course she can do those papers like you said. And she got married last summer, and she'd been here 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. She came out here that Sunday, and I had to go over to Louise Graham. And she had that Western music. I didn't know she's interested in Louise Graham.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I thought Suzanne'd be bored. Well, her eyes just sparkled a little bit. And she was helpful. And on the way home, she started talking about it. Jim's her husband's parents, you know. Just brought up on it. And she made this statement. What they like about it is they're avoiding the present and holding on to the past. Well, I went along with her on it, and like you say, you adjust your statement. And she said it was the first time she'd been mental all summer and all fall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what she'd call it, but she felt a great relief, and it was so simple. And I don't know what you are in courses.
Just wearing.
I don't know, you see. I don't have the distinctions for it. But you don't have that feeling that you're reading the thing and Chaucer, the Monk's Tale or something, and looking at it and testing it. You don't feel that.
You think it's, you make something up. It's fake because you make something up. To work on, you just work it up out of the air, and you develop it, and it's nothing to you.
Yeah,
you know, you do it because
nothing.
You have to do it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean a thing to you. You do it, you develop your point, and you turn in, and that's it. Never see it again. Never think about it again.
Yeah.
So what happens is, it's just a big waste of time.
Well, now you see, let the subject be what it may. Those people out here, what's the names? You're out there, Hawthorne.
Oh, the Mullins.
Mullins. You know, with a light touch and with contact with them, that can have all sorts of
revelations. Sure, I know. That's why I've been carrying it around with me for 2 or 3 months.
Revelations in it. because it doesn't matter.
Remember, you know, Suzanne says she plots all week to make some time to come out here. So that,
that's what I do too.
So that
most
she,
I'm
can,
not
so she can be mental. But her first letter, when she went back, this examining experience made it possible for her to look at Jim's family.
Yes, that's right.
Not only to look at Jim's family, but to appreciate Jim's family. And she would have been intolerant had it not been that way.
That's
and
right.
Remember the first letter we had from Christmas?
Yeah, she wrote. Yeah. She got on there Monday and wrote Tuesday. Where was that? Say, I've got it over there.
I have just made
an astounding
discovery. Nell is perceptive. That's Jim's mother.
Foster parents can be perceptive. Uh-huh. And Nell, her Jim's mother, had
mm-hmm.
just talked, and Nell knew all those things about Western music that she
mm-hmm.
had just been sort of
inquiring
into.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And see, you know what I was telling you before, though, about the anthropological approach, it had kind of that effect, though, when I went out to Hawthorne, because I doubt it would have been intolerant completely, you know, but it just gave me a little extra something to look at the people there. I think the most valuable thing you ever can study in school is anthropology, because it can give you an appreciation for anything that's different from yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'll follow you on that. I'll go along with you on that. But I don't think that, and I may give you a hard time, but I'd like to get your point of view, so don't let me jump you too much. You
don't worry. But I really think that anthropology has just got to be one of the most valuable subjects, because it shows you that your way isn't the only way.
Well, how? Really?
I mean, you approach it in most basic anthropology courses. You approach it from, you look at linguistics, you look at religion, you look at all these different things. But it's not these specifics that help you. It's just the attitude.
Uh-huh.
Just the attitude.
Well,
of knowing, of wanting to know.
A part of the 18th century Enlightenment was a tolerance, and a part of tolerance was their beginning of comparative cultures.
Mm-hmm.
The Orient was, they were getting closer to
right,
it.
Right, yeah.
And they could look at the Germans. You know, that was a part of their tolerance. Now to be comparative cultures. Is that sort of anthropology?
The same kind of thing. But you see, to me, it came home even more to me in the linguistics part of it. Because then, see, the whole thesis of this course I took was that your thought is controlled by your language. And that your patterns of thought control your outlook on the world. And every language that's different from Indo-European, every language has different patterns in it. Like the idea that the Hopi Indians have about time compared with our idea of time, and the effect that it has on their lives compared with the way we feel about
time. Don't you tell me what the Hopi Indians think about time unless you tell me.
Okay, I'll tell you. They think they have no verb tenses. They feel that everything is either here or it's somewhere out in the great beyond. They call it objective and subjective. Something is either here or it's in the process of manifesting itself. They never worry about something, whether it's coming tomorrow or it was yesterday. It's either here or it's out there somewhere. And they just have a completely different outlook. They don't have calendars. They don't say, it's going to happen tomorrow. What are we going to do tomorrow? They don't divide things up in the way we do at all. And from our language, with the structure that we have of past, present, and future, it tends to make us real self-conscious about time and segmenting things. They have nothing like that. No conception of past,
well,
present,
now you,
and future.
You can apply that to experience.
Sure.
Experience is
sure.
Really not past.
Or you can say that there's really no present.
That's right.
Because when you perceive it, it's already gone.
Yes. Yes, that's a logical way of doing it. But just the actual way is that you see that little encounter with the boy punching the other boy in the face and then punching through the door That's right now that you're looking at it. You look at it. You don't remember it.
No.
It's
you
not.
You carry the action around your mind.
I don't know what you do, but it's wrong, I think, to say you recall it. You remember it.
Well, see, remember what Emerson says, though, that, you know, you have this, it's part of you, and then at some point, and nobody, you know, you can't tell exactly when it detaches itself and starts to float up, that what you're talking about is it's still with you before it detaches and becomes thought. Right?
There's possibly something in there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's what, yeah, the way Emerson looks at it. He says that what's happening to you, right, is you keep with you until at some point it becomes a memory or a picture that you can look back on.
After you convert it into thought.
Right.
Okay. Well, you see, that opens up things. That gives the mind wheels.
See, you know, this thing about the time and language and thought and all this business is, they teach that in Freshman English now. That's what I've been doing the past couple of weeks. I've been having a lot of fun with that.
Mm-hmm.
The kids resist it, you know. They don't want to think that other cultures can look at them. They can't imagine that other cultures, that's how, you'd think they'd be more broad-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'd understand this, but they don't. They don't see it at all.
Mm-hmm.
They can't understand how other languages can be so different and people can look at things so differently.
Mm-hmm.
See, now they go out to Hawthorne, and what are they going to be like? They're going to resist it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a whole
that's
different
right.
worldview.
They know ahead of time what they're going to see.
That's
exactly.
Right.
They've got it all classified. They have words for it, just like in that poem I was telling you about.
Mm-hmm.
Once they have the classes, then they can't look at it like as a child would look at it, say.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You think Buster
looks at it?
Looks at it?
He has, well, I couldn't tell whether he was putting something on for his audience or not. You know, there's a certain element of...
No, I think it's everything was straightforward, except he didn't...
He got a little bit...
...give any dirty jokes. He's, he's a spender. No.
I can do either.
I try to be the wrong way. I'm spared those.
Well, he was working up to it when we were outside.
Yes. And we didn't squash
it. We sidetracked him.
Yeah.
We didn't encourage him.
Now, I'll tell you, he didn't hold on. He examined that. He didn't hang on to that view that the soot out of the chimney, the smoke out of the chimney would just keep on going up and up and up in the space.
No.
He modified that.
All the different conditions that it would.
Without any knowledge at all, you see, he might.
Yeah, the cold air is heavy. You know, it holds that smoke down.
Yeah. I used to, he's nice to do that.
But, you know, rarely did you feel that he was remembering something. The experience was rather was right with him, pretty much.
Yeah. He just didn't follow it through.
That's right.
He got sidetracked so much by every little thought brought up another new thought that he wanted to, you know, follow.
Yeah.
And
he didn't understand it.
He didn't.
Now, his view of the clan, he was, he kept that rather open.
Yeah.
And he's had more recent experiences than which he didn't.
Yeah,
have.
I saw you were trying to goad him into that, you know, asking him if that recent thing was in really in 1946 or if I was wanting for him to say something about that. I was hoping that he'd talk about a meeting they had last week. I would have been real interested in that.
The Grand Dragon came down, and he was one of his cohorts, the information I have, about a year or two. But it certainly wasn't back and forth in 1946.
Yeah.
And the thing fizzled on their hands.
Well, that made me think of the Hooded Americans. Have you read that book?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Dr., what's his name? Chalmers? That did that. He used to go out and disguise him. And you know, do you know a man named Forrest Burghorn?
Mm-hmm.
He's another young man in institutions. They used to go out and sneak into these meetings, you know. And they have unbelievable experiences that they've had. I mean, it's not just like remove their study of the clan.
Oh.
They've gone out and gone to these meetings all over the place, you know, and gathered up all kinds of literature and information.
Well, now in some cases they don't have to sneak. They just Yeah, right.
But these were the kind, you know, that they had to sneak. They were supposed to be the inside group.
Yes. Is there a paperback of that?
I think so.
Pick one up. I might use it amongst some of my friends. I don't go into forbidden subjects much. I never have. There's no use to it.
Well, he didn't really shy off from that too much.
Well,
he wanted to put it in the past, though. That was pretty.
And he wanted to say that they were just interested
in
good work.
Right. Yeah, but I really had to laugh when he got to the part, you know, about how they're just interested in good work, and they go out and they coerce these people into doing exactly what they want. My idea of a good work and his idea of a good work are a long way apart.
Well, you see, in reporting, a man has a flaw, and you never, there's never a rejoinder.
I can see that.
Any rejoinder has to come in your own reporting.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you cut it off.
Sure.
It's not reporting anymore. So, in his reporting, you're not testing the truth.
Sure,
you're not actually taking the validity. You're looking at his point of view.
No, that's why I didn't say anything.
You don't question his
yeah.
interpretation or his information. You just see.
You just take the way he looks at it.
Yeah. Yes, isn't
which
that
was
nice?
Kind of funny.
Yes.
And then you can use it the way he looks at it.
Or else you'd never find out if you squelch him with your own opinions first.
That's what Baldwin would do.
Well, she can walk the horse down the lane.
I've got to go pick up my husband.
She got to get a touch a horse, babe, while she's here.
Well,
don't you want?
I'll get a touch a horse.
Go touch a horse.
You don't want
to
go. Six. John's gonna be having a fit.
Put Hubie into the pasture. Oats down there.
Okay. All right. I was going to make John a cake before she left.
I think he's going to come out next weekend with me.
All right, I'll have him a cake next.
I tried to con him into it, but
he was
too diligent.
Yes, pure, solid information. This is one time when I remember this. It just sort of pushes me off balance. It takes me a good while to recover. I think, well, if I don't, I notice things. I say, she said, the little girl, Nancy, has so much energy. I said, well, and Carla. Well, I said, they come by naturally, you and Carla both have it. No, she says, we have drive. My mother has stamina. And you've heard her go into that?
Not very much.
She says her mother does her work when she gets back from work at midnight. She sews for her and for Carl. And sleeps 3 or 4 hours a night. Now you see, I could live 100 years and I never would pick up such information.
About yourself. Yeah. I would
say if you and Florence both, you see, that you have a sort of preternatural amount of energy. And she says, no, you have drive.
Well, she's right. I think she's right, or she's right about that.
Now, this is the same sort of perception that they have.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Our faith. It seemingly is just natural for her, and my father had it. It's a natural thing. You just look at people and sort of see how it is. Now, I could look at somebody all day, and you'd be what I think you ought to be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's my trouble.
Wouldn't be what you really are. You'd be what I make you be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have ideas of what a person
but
should
Florence
be.
Is head on. She sees it.
Yeah.
I think she does. And we're being fey into her.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But is that kind of a person?
It's a gift. I certainly don't have it. So she does most of the talking. I'm learning, you see. I can use books and handle them and all like that. But I don't have that. You see, I don't have that common that's not an erudite gift, you see. That's... you're born with it. I don't know that education helps you. Well, it would. It might ruin it.
Does everybody Florence know call on her for things? I know they do, you too. But it just seems like everybody I know calls on you and Florence for everything.
Well, of course they don't.
Can't go to Sunday school without somebody.
Well, it isn't any burden. But
you have one protection. That's the office. I have a protection in my case because I'm too busy.
Florence is solving problems for people
all the time.
And what's a perfect example is just like one of the waitresses calls her up Monday or Tuesday Monday last week and says, my baby has got a sore eye, and could your husband phone a prescription to the drugstore in McIntosh, or would he need to see the baby? So she called me, and I said, well, look,
isn't it?
Yeah, see,
both of them.
Yeah, both of them. They're just like
it. So I said, I don't need to. If it's Florida sore eye, and she knows what it is, and many of these people around here do, you see, I said, well, now she doesn't need to come and see me. And we called the girl in the office, call the drugstore down here. Well, what happened was that they didn't have any medicine at the drugstore. Well, I think the story ought to end there, but what happened was, it doesn't really end there because Florence has another interlude with it.
Yeah.
Because the girl comes back to the restaurant that night, and the story was that because they couldn't get the medicine, and instead of calling back, see, it really would have been easier to call Florence back and say, what do we do now? Well, go to Ocala and get it, and we can call Ocala for 25 cents, see. Nothing.
No, of course it ain't.
Yeah. Well, but I'm in Gainesville, see. But it wouldn't matter. See, it wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
Because we're just trying to do something. And they end up at the doctor in another town. Mind you, see, they've already embarrassed me, so they can't come to see me. This is what's so pitiful.
Yeah.
They go to the other doctor, and they get a shot of penicillin, and I think she said 3 prescriptions, 4 medications. And then the mother, see, reason the story doesn't end is that this is not reasonable to the mother. When the eye doctor prescribed drops, another doctor, not an eye doctor, prescribes a shot and 3 prescriptions, and well, Florence told me about it. She was almost in tears. She said, the only thing I could tell her was that I never can remember Carl giving a shot of penicillin for sore eyes.
Yeah.
Because the mother was questioning the psychiatrist. So not only do you have to help them with the problem, you have to help them after they have to help them after they've had a bad solution. See?
Yeah. There you are.
Yeah. It's amazing, really, the part that's I guess we're talking like a doctor now, is how difficult it is for average people to get a simple problem solved. This is what's a little.
Yeah.
That's right.
I had a patient in the office this week, and he was a little distraught. He had been a patient of mine for over a year, and I nursed him through one difficult problem. It took 3 months, and he told me it would take 3 months because that's how long it took the last time he was sick. And he doesn't remember that I encouraged him to go to the medical center and get a valid consultation and a recommendation for some definitive solution that I wasn't capable of doing for him. I wanted somebody else to do it. He said no, he would prefer to stay with me, and he knew it would get well if we would just persevere a little, so we persevered a little, and he got well. Well, he had a recurrence of this problem, and it was very severe. And this was while I was on vacation, and he went to see another doctor who sent him to the medical center in a hurry, and he got very satisfactory treatment for his problem. A few weeks later, which was just this last week, his eye was just worse than ever, and he couldn't reach the doctor at the medical center that was doing the prescribing, and I don't know why he didn't call me, because he's seeing me concurrently with the others. So he decided to just stop all the medicine and put ice packs on his eye, and you know, according to him, his eye got well on 4 days of ice packs, and when I saw him on Thursday, his eye looked better than I've seen it look, and I had to just simply declare him well. And he says, what do you want me to do now? And I said, well, that part's not important. What is important, he said, I think that you doctors sometimes over-treat. And I said, well, I agree with you. And he says, I think you'll have to agree with me. He wouldn't let me up, you see. And he said, especially those young doctors, he says, they'll write you 4 prescriptions while they're talking.
Yeah.
And I confessed to him. I said, well, you know, there's something final about a prescription. I said, it kind of brings things to a head and a conclusion, and you have to move on to the next thing after you've written a prescription.
Yeah.
And the patient can go out with something definite in
his hand. Yeah, and he reads all this, but he knows that it's not. But he's perceptive enough to know that this is not the best treatment always. And so we.
Well, you see, in Guy's case, I felt when he went in at one time, the doctor said, he said, now look, just take, I've got these samples, just take them, you know. And you know, this is the sort of thing he sees all the time, an infection, you know. I mean, it's just routine.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what threw me off. I thought, well, you know,
yeah,
he's not taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to save you expense. And why should you go over and have an x-ray when he doesn't think it's necessary?
Yeah.
He'd have you take it. But it just went too long.
Yeah, but do you know that this is the same doctor that sees me on the ward, and when I ask him what to do about I don't even ask him. He tells me that red blood cells in the urine, see, now this might be different from pus, you see, but the phenomenon of red in the cells requires a thorough investigation.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
Well, why doesn't pus
uh-huh.
require a thorough mm-hmm. evaluation?
Especially over this period of time?
Well, the answer, it does, and this is...
6 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, Florence would say, and she called me, and she said, now, just hang on, just go in there and just stand up to that doctor, you know. I do, she said, just don't let him put you off. Get
something
done.
This is so cute, see, because when her mother was having a problem and couldn't get any help, see, her mother went through the same thing.
Yeah.
All
she
did.
Was laughing, but she was so sympathetic to God.
That's right, see, this is right. But when I was dealing with the problem of Florence and her inability to get her problem solved, see, her problem was her mother's illness,
mm-hmm.
which all incidentally was all at that same
yes.
low ebb.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was part of the, it precipitated her. It went along with that. I was finally reduced to the ultimatum to her that you either have to accept what you have or you just simply have to go get another doctor. It's that simple. See? It's that simple. And, she never did, see? I mean, it was a great deal of anguish for her because she never was able to understand or rationalize or forgive the fact that the doctor was unable to distinguish between a organic illness which he thought she had and a mental illness which she did have, you see. And the interesting part is that since that time she's had an opportunity to advise you and standing up to your doctor, you see.
Yeah.
And she advised dear Mrs. Pierce, who had all this glowing faith in her doctor, but she kept on having a headache, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, her headache was precipitated, and her great distress was, Mrs. Pierce's distress was precipitated by the rape of the 82-year-old lady, remember?
Yes, I remember the paper.
Well, that's her sister-in-law.
Oh.
Oh,
no.
Yes. Her,
I didn't know.
Her, it's, no, it's her brother, it's her, that's her, no, that's her nephew's, yeah, that's her sister-in-law, it's her nephew's mother.
Yes, it did, but I guess it didn't.
No, it doesn't anymore.
No. So you wouldn't
have
thought somebody
might... You can go out and shoot yourself, and it's still
there. Is that
good.
Right?
Yeah, you may not get double indemnity or whatever you call it, but it's...
Well, she got that double indemnity. I understand that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just hearsay.
Well, now, she's better off than she ever has been.
Well, she went with me over to Citra, the church. Last week, one night, they were having a revival over there, and on the way over there, something was said concerning our husbands. And I said, sometimes I wonder, if I could bring Tom back, would I do it? She said, well, I know I wouldn't burn him if he was going to live like he always did. It was about drive her crazy.
Mm.
And she just spoke right up and quit and said, I know I wouldn't if he was going to live like he always lived.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess... She's living better than she ever has lived.
In more ways than one.
Yeah, yeah.
Less botheration.
That was one thing I always said, Dr. Miles. I told my husband before we got married, we were both 18 years old, we got married. He had to promise me he wouldn't ever drink.
Yeah.
And he lived up to it.
Yeah.
The day before he got that poison, he sat around there on the back and said, have you ever forgot the only promise I ever made you and we agreed on? I said, sure have, and I will tell you, I greatly appreciate it.
Well, I'll tell you, these days, the children don't pay attention to that.
I know it.
They just, all the liquor ads and here, there, and yonder, you see, it's
dope or anything,
open,
yeah. That's
open,
right.
The world's open.
That's right.
Now, that don't mean it's not got traps in it.
No, it sure don't.
Just
really
as many
don't.
As it ever had.
That's right.
But they don't feel it that way. You know, we had, I remember, oh, there's a good bit of it when I grew up. But right close to me, we had one drunken member of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember what agony, you know, they suffered.
That is pure living hell on earth.
All through the night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For a week at a time, it
mm-hmm.
seemed to me like. I can remember that.
I know. That was one thing that I always thought. Now, I don't know what I'd have done if I'd have had to face it, but I believe I do.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have put up with it. I just... Sure, I wouldn't
know. Well, now, Bernie had good times out there, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
And when you all was working out there together.
One thing about Bernie Bass, I never called him in my life to do anything. It was just, ma'am, I'll be right there. Or I could go there before we had telephones out here and say, Bernie, I need you to do so-and-so. I don't care what he started, he laid it down and he come done that.
Was he on Ms. Rawlings?
Yeah.
You know him?
Yeah. Sure does. He writes something in Cross Creek Book about the Bernie Bass.
Yeah. Well, what do you know?
Yeah.
I looked that up. I can't remember. Maybe that's where I remember the name.
I expect it is. I expect that's where you remember. Bernie, as he got older, when Bernie first moved around here, he didn't drink that much. But
yeah.
As he got older, not the way his daddy did before him, as he got older, he drank worse and worse, and Bernie was doing the same thing. About every doctor. He'd work up there all day. Well, he'd get his beer when he started home. Next morning, he'd go back to work, and then on Friday evening, he'd kind of load it up for Saturday and Sunday. So he just got worse and worse.
And he started a little bit too soon.
That's right.
Friday.
That's right.
Well, that's sad. That is sad. You see, that's a good promising life come to such a... That's one of the trouble getting old yourself, isn't it?
That's right.
You see all
you see it so much plainer.
It's so much plainer.
I do. It seems to me like I know that as you get older, you see these things. I can see so much danger now that I used to never think of that.
Yeah.
I see these youngsters out doing things, and I knew I'd have done the same thing when I was their age. And it is so dangerous.
Let me tell you, the other night on the television, I didn't watch it. I have a habit of turning it on to see what's on.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I see something. There was a beautiful thing on the Okie Smokie show on Channel 5. And I just accidentally turned that on. And I taped it. And Evan and I now listen to it.
Uh-huh.
It's beautiful. He plays the mouth organ and they talk about it. And they had drag racing on.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my other regulation is drag racing. Well, it's accepted now, you see.
Oh.
The policemen find a place for them to drag race, and then they have the national meeting.
Uh-huh.
And they were just going around in the audience, most of the kids. And, they're all just going through that. And they say, yes, they like it because you're so fast.
Uh-huh.
Another said they like it because you're so noisy.
Uh-huh.
And then another one said, well, it's over in 6 seconds. Just a little short spurt.
You know, it's right amusing to me. This oldest boy, mine's daughter, she was 16 the last of April, and she got her driver's license. Well, how they'll want to drive fast.
Yes, sir.
Right to start.
Yes.
They don't see a bit of danger in the water, and I say, Donya, if you make a habit, don't drive over 40 or 50 miles an hour until you know that you know how to drive. Why, she say, they'd run me off the road if I didn't drive no faster than that. Well, her daddy wouldn't let her drive off by herself anywhere because he kept after all the time. She won't start off and get it up to 70 at least, you know. Well, I told him one day, I said, if she could just run into one little the car skid in or something, but not hurt nobody or not turn over. I said, I bet she never would forget that.
Whenever you all come over there, just drop around there and look in on us 2 minutes. We appreciate that.
Oh, well, I've thought about it, but you know, I've been kind of down under the weather, and I had some surgery back the 5th of June, and I'm just kind of getting over
it. Well, I didn't know about that.
I had a hernia that was in my side that had been about to kill me for years. And they say they couldn't do nothing about it on account of my heart condition.
Yeah.
I went in there the 1st of June, and the doctor said we could take care of that now. You're built up enough that we can do it. Well, they had told me dozens of times I wouldn't wake up if they put me to sleep. And I said, you just hold on here a little bit. I've had you and a half a dozen more in here tell me that I would never wake up if I was put to sleep. And I'm not ready to be put to sleep right now. But he had two more doctors come in, and they assured me that they felt that it would be safe. So
I don't
see
like that
going to
wake up anytime.
Mine does that
sometimes. I just didn't get it's interested in what we're talking about. What's Ms. Bass do now? What prospect has she?
Well,
they
were the children? Oh, they've got these 4 children, 3 more than the girl. This oldest boy started a little store in Hawthorne, selling, you know, stuff that like he handles there. He gets a lot of it, and he brings it there. To the youngest boy, he lived up there, his younger brother. Well, this boy is a good plumber, and he holds a pretty good job all the time, so he got his mother, even before Bernie got killed, to go up there and take care of this place, this store, until, you know, for him while he's off working somewhere else. Well, that's what she's doing and has right on.
Well, that's all right.
It's all right.
That'll keep her,
keeps her busy.
Enough to do.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe a little money.
Not too much responsibility. She don't need money.
No, I don't think so.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, it sure would. I never have seen that kind yet.
I don't know how I'd feel. I don't know whether that'd be a good feeling or not.
Dr. Bob, if I had your money, I wouldn't have worked for it.
If you knew how little I got along on. I'm not,
But what are you saving it for?
I don't put in much time.
Yeah, but I know that you're drawing plenty. I know that.
I put in just enough time to sort of get by. You know, I'm ashamed of that sometimes. I remember one of my colleagues one time. He said, well, I can live on what I make all right. But he said, I have so little to give away. And he was the sort that did that.
Uh-huh.
And when he joined the church and tithed, he tithed. He didn't just talk about it. And then anything come along, he'd give his time and his money. And I think about that.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, it would be more useful to the community if you'd go ahead and work a little bit more.
Well, I guess you would. But I tell you, it takes all the working you do to keep them taxes paid. You'll make it.
Your field looks mighty good up there now.
Well, I had got kind of worried that he wasn't going to mow it. Last year he waited till I know a lot of them coffee beans seeded out.
Yeah.
And it was in our contract that he'd keep it mowed.
Yeah.
And I called him one night on Friday night and I said, Mr. Arnold, have you forgot how our contract read? And he said, what you mean? I said, what you going to do about them coffee weeds growing over there? And they were tall then. He said, I'm going to let the coal kill them. I said, now, Mr. Arnold, you know that wasn't in our contract. You just keep them weeds mowed, not let them seed out. He said, they won't seed before it turns cold and the frost kills them. So they won't. Well, I know a coffee bean better than that. So I said, no, I'm not going to let them coffee weeds stay there till they seed out now, Mr. Arnold. If you're not going to mow them, I am.
Didn't he know anybody?
Yeah, he did. He thought I didn't. That was just the whole thing. And he said, oh, I don't think they will. I just feel like that the coal will kill them before them seed mature. I said, your foot, you don't know coffee weeds.
Yeah.
So I said, well, you just tell me if you're not going to do it, because I'm going to put a boy in there mowing them. And Monday morning, he had two tractors running mowing them. So this year, I kept watching them, and they got worse because a lot of them seeded and fell out.
Yeah.
Because they was worse than they were.
You know the easiest way to take care of coffee weeds?
No.
2,4-D.
Spray them?
It's the only cheap spray I know. A whole drum of water, you put about a cup full of 2,4-D.
I tell you though, Mister, now Dr. Miles, you start to spray in that 200 or 300 acres and
you can spray it quicker than you can
mow
it, and furthermore, they won't come back.
Well, that's true because, I imagine you spray off what, a 20 or 30 foot strip at a time?
I just.
You could do it.
Well, you could do it, but I don't do it that way. I just go out there and whenever I see one, I spray it. See, I got a nozzle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And.
They won't come back.
They just will. Next day, a couple hours almost, they nod. And once they nod, that's it.
Well, I understand now. That they're no more hoeing of orange trees. They spray around them.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, they do. All down south, they spray. They spray under the trees around where they usually would have to hoe. And this boy that works at County Agent, O'Callor, had told me I've got a spray pump that I used to spray the cows for flies.
Mm-hmm.
And, he told me that he was going to fix a rig to spray these trees instead of mowing them. I used to hoe them about September, October. That we'd spray them, and that he could fix that to where we could spray them with this pump. I don't see why he was cutting, because we had to put a drum of water, and we'd have to fix the tractor with a little compartment in the back to set the drum. I don't see why he couldn't. If I was able to do it, I think
yeah.
I could.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I got an old broken down trailer, and I put a couple of drums of water on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, the best time to do it is in the morning when the sun warms up. Because the 2,4-D works better when you got the metabolism. And if it stays on an hour, it can rain if it wants to.
Don't
it? Yeah. And you can do it pretty well, Jack.
Well, I've got an old trailer out there, and I had told this friend of mine, I said, I don't see why we couldn't. We've got everything to do it with.
Yeah.
It runs off of the tractor.
That's right.
Yeah, no, I don't see why we couldn't. They just haven't got time. The oldest boy left about 3 weeks ago and went to Pennsylvania, and he was sure that he's going to help me a lot.
Oh, yeah. He's nice to have around.
Oh, yeah. He was good right here.
Yeah.
The man that I had that worked with me regularly, he had a pretty bad operation. I do the last Civil War. I understood to start with that was going to be a pretty bad operation.
Uh-huh.
And he hadn't got over it yet, the incision on heel.
Oh.
And they cut him half in two. They cut him from his backbone around to the center of his stomach, trimmed some of his ribs. Well, now one of the ribs got infected, and they've had to take out the most of that rib. And it just... He's been in there the fourth time that they went into that place trying to make it heal. It all healed, but the place about that long, and it just won't heal. It'll keep on till it gets infected, then it goes running on fever.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I don't know how I missed that's so big and open. Faye would see that. She'd be after me.
Well, you know what I'm up against with it all now? Doctors is telling me I must put in air conditioning.
Yeah.
And I never like to stay in a closed up house.
Yeah.
I like my house wide open.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was raised in the country and I like it. I always have lived in it. I love it.
Yeah.